Shrink Wrap Radio Number 30, March 26, 2006, Scientific Parapsychology. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Allman is a psychotherapist, and he began to notice that many of his clients were having dreams about his personal life. So he thought, why not put this into a laboratory setting and monitor people's dreams with the electroencephalograph machine and associated devices, wake them up after it seems that they have had a dream, while a person in a distant room or a distant building is looking at a vivid picture or a vivid film clip of some sort or another, trying to transmit the contents of that into the person's dream. Just a very neat, simple, direct experimental setup with all sorts of inbuilt controls. And then we had outside judges try to match the night of dreams to the correct picture. Now, if we had 12 nights of dreams and 12 pictures, the chances are that they'd be able to do this one out of 12. Instead, we were coming up with 7, 8, 9, or 10 hits out of 12, which was statistically significant.
You've just heard the voice of Dr. Stanley Krippner, good friend and world-renowned psychologist, describing the groundbreaking paradigm of his research into parapsychology. Since 1973, Dr. Krippner has been professor of psychology at the Saybrook Graduate School and Research Center in San Francisco, California. I've titled this episode Scientific Parapsychology. Now, for those already invested in the scientific investigation of extrasensory perception and other psychic phenomena, the phrase scientific parapsychology may seem redundant, since they would equate the word parapsychology with the scientific study of these phenomena. However, I'd guess that most people outside the field would equate the term parapsychology to a wide variety of popular accounts of unusual experiences. So I wanted to underscore the fact that there have been and there are a small band of pioneers who have brought the rigorous methods of science to bear on the intriguing but elusive phenomena associated with the term ESP or extrasensory perception. Now today's guest, Dr. Stanley Krippner, stands out as one of the foremost of these scientific investigators. To fully appreciate Stanley Krippner's contributions to psychology in general, and parapsychology in particular, you really must visit his website at www.stanleykrippner.com, and that's spelled STANLEYKRIPPNER.com. And there you will find links to the 25 books that he has authored or co-authored. Beyond that, you'll discover a host of books that he's edited. And then beyond that, you'll find a long list of chapters contributed to books, more than I really wanted to take time to count. And then if you look at his list of scientific papers and presentations, they run into the hundreds. And then he has a list of awards. His list of awards is too long to read, so I really refer you to the website, but let me just give you a feel for it. He received the Ashley Montague Peace Award, also the American Psychological Association Award for Distinguished Contribution to Professional Hypnosis. He received the American Psychological Association Award for Distinguished Contributions to the International Advancement of Psychology. He received the Dr. J.B. Ryan Award for Lifetime Achievement in Parapsychology. He received the Latin American Parapsychology Award. He received the Outstanding Career Award from the Parapsychological Association. He received a Pathfinder Award from the Association for Humanistic Psychology. He received a Citation of Merit from the National Association for Creative Children and Adults, and another Citation of Merit from the National Association for Gifted Children. He received the Service to Youth Award from the YMCA. And the list goes on. All of this may help you to understand why I'm so excited and feel so privileged to be able to share the following interview with you. Stanley, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. I could take all of our time just introducing you. I Googled you and I came up with 59,800 references to your name. Your list of publications is way too long to recite, so clearly there isn't time to cover all your accomplishments and honors here. So I'll refer my listeners to your website at stanleykrippner.com. Which will also...
I have never Googled myself. I had no idea there were that many.
Yeah, I know. It's fairly shocking. So there'll be a link to that website in our show notes. Now, you're a top authority in more areas of psychology than anyone else I know of. And I'm not sure I even know all of your areas of specialization. The ones I know about are dreams, mythology, consciousness, hypnosis, parapsychology, healing, creativity, special education, and peace studies. Have I left any out?
You did a better job than I could ever have done.
Okay. Now, out of all of this wealth of knowledge and accomplishment, I'd like to focus in on parapsychology. In the middle 60s and early 70s, you were director of the Dream Laboratory at Maimonides Hospital in Brooklyn, New York. And during that period, you carried out what struck me as a series of very tightly controlled studies on mental telepathy and precognition. Could you give us a brief recap of that work?
Well, yes, I'll be happy to. And the third edition of our book, Dream Telepathy, is now available by Ullman, Krippner, and Vaughn. And that tells the whole story for any of your listeners who might be interested.
Wonderful.
But Ullman is a psychotherapist, and he began to notice that many of his clients were having dreams about his personal life. So he thought, why not put this into a laboratory setting and monitor people's dreams with the electroencephalograph machine and associated devices, wake them up after it seems that they have had a dream, while a person in a distant room or a distant building is looking at a vivid picture or a vivid film clip of some sort or another, trying to transmit the contents of that into the person's dream. Just a very neat, simple, direct experimental setup with all sorts of inbuilt controls. And then we had outside judges try to match the night of dreams to the correct picture. Now, if we had 12 nights of dreams and 12 pictures, the chances are that they'd be able to do this 1 out of 12. Instead, we were coming up with 7, 8, 9, or 10 hits out of 12, which was statistically significant.
Wow.
We did that research for 10 years, and we also did two pieces of research with what we call precognition, where the picture would not be selected until the following day. And people did equally well on the precognition studies. Now, in science, you can't make any great claims unless something is replicated in other laboratories. And over the past couple of decades, Some people in laboratories have replicated it, and some people have not.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know why this happens. People can't replicate it too easily. And I had one hunch, which we tracked down, and that was there was something really beyond personality rapport and telepathy or precognition talent. And we went back over our data and looked at what was happening with the geomagnetic field during the nights that the experiments were going on.
Hmm.
In other words, were there sunspot activities? Were there electrical storms? And what we found out was that the most successful nights were the correspondences between the target, the picture, and the dreams, were nights when there was very low geomagnetic activity, where there were not storms, there was not much sunspot activity. So this gives us a clue that whatever ESP is, It's something that is affected by the ambient geomagnetic environment. And so it's a field effect, a very complicated field effect, and one that we probably don't know all the variables for, but at least this gave us a clue as to what a few of the variables were.
Right. And didn't you also in your research find that emotionality, emotional intensity of the pictures that people were looking at played a role, and also that some people seemed to have more of a natural propensity or talent than others?
Yes, we found out that in spontaneous cases, the cases that people write in about or that they remember or report, there's usually some emotion involved. If a loved one is in danger, for example,
right.
We'll often have a telepathic dream about that person. So we chose pictures that were very emotionally intense, and sometimes a picture that was more bland and more ordinary came up through randomization, and those usually didn't have as much of a punch telepathically as the ones that had the emotional intensity to them.
Okay. Now, you also achieved some widespread fame or notoriety or something. You did some large-scale psychic experiments at Grateful Dead concerts. Can you replay a little bit of that for us?
Well, that was done just for fun.
Okay.
I knew the Grateful Dead and still keep in touch with a few of the members of the old group. And we thought it would be fun to try to have their entire audience at a series of concerts in Port Chester, New York, send a randomly chosen picture, which was flashed on the screen in back of the Grateful Dead, to somebody sleeping in our laboratory. And the people at the concert were looking at a light show, and all of a sudden on the light show there were instructions, "You are about to participate in a telepathy experiment. At this moment, Malcolm Besant is asleep at the Maimonides Dream Laboratory in Brooklyn, New York. In a few moments, you will be shown a picture. Try to telepathically send it to him." And then the person running the slide projector flipped a coin, and the coin determined which slide would go into the machine next. That was flashed on the screen. Members of the Grateful Dead would make some comments about the picture, and then they'd go ahead and keep playing. Well, we did that for 6 nights, very small number of nights, but the results were, shall we say, marginally significant. Four out of the 6 nights, there was a fairly close correspondence. One night, the painting was by the Middle Eastern artist Skralian of a man meditating, and you could see the seven spinal chakras in color, and the dreamer, Mr. Besant, actually had a dream about the spinal column.
Wow.
And several dreams about energy centers.
Hmm.
Well, that was the closest correspondence. The others weren't so close. But even though that was sort of a pilot study and one that only involved a few nights, that has been written up in Stories About the Grateful Dead, which was written up in popular magazines. And like I say, it's really the best known of all of our studies, even though it was one that we did just for kicks, just for fun.
Yeah, yeah. I was talking to a mutual friend the other day and mentioning that we were going to be speaking in this interview, and he reminded me that you were a fairly regular guest for a while on the Johnny Carson show. Is that true?
I did one appearance on the Johnny Carson
show. Oh, okay.
And people have seen those reruns so often that they think that I was a regular guest. This just comes up time and time again.
Uh-huh.
But I'll tell you, the most interesting aspect of that Johnny Carson show was during the intermission when I talked with Tony Randall, who was also a guest. Tony Randall, the distinguished actor who unfortunately died a few years ago.
Yeah.
But very, very fine actor and producer, had his own acting company in New York at the time of his death. And he told me his story about going to a psychiatrist because he was having anxiety attacks, and then the psychiatrist was telling him that he was taking amphetamines and he could get twice as much done and see twice as many patients as he could without the amphetamines. And then he forgot who Tony Randall was, and he mixed him up with other patients. It was obvious the amphetamines were burning out his brain cells. And then the psychiatrist committed suicide.
Oh, my goodness.
And so Randall thought, look, I've concluded my psychotherapy. I have no more anxiety attacks. I haven't been back to a psychiatrist since.
Good story.
So that was the high point of the Johnny Carson show for me, and that didn't even get on TV.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm glad to be in on that. Now, I know you as someone who is a strong believer in the canons of science, on the one hand, and at the same time, someone who keeps an open mind about an amazing array of paranormal phenomena that people have reported. And I've always marveled at this ability that you have to kind of tread that tightrope. I know people have told you about the wildest sorts of paranormal experiences imaginable. And I know you believe in empirical science, and somehow you never invalidate anyone. How do you pull that off?
To be very frank with you, I don't believe in much of anything.
Interesting.
Yes, I believe that the scientific method is our best guard against self-deception. And there are a number of social and political issues that I believe in very strongly. But in terms of these supposedly paranormal experiences, I play with them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not ready to say I believe with them, but I play around with the possibilities. And when people have these experiences and tell me about them, I'm not going to invalidate their experience. Of course, there might be any number of ordinary explanations, but how am I to know? So I just listen courteously, and if they ever seem to be going off the deep edge, or if they ever seem to be taking something too seriously in a way that might damage them, then I might step in and I might say, well, you know, the evidence demonstrates such and such and so and so. So I'd be a little more skeptical about doing this if I were you. I'd think twice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I do make an intervention if I see somebody in danger of taking an unwarranted risk. But other than that, sure, I play around with the ideas, I enjoy hearing about them, and I learn something from them.
Interesting. Yeah, and
And of course, I always think, now, how could this be turned into a scientific study? How could this be put into some rigorous framework so we could verify this or nullify this?
Yeah, and that's one of your distinguishing characteristics, I think. And as I say, you do have a gift for somehow holding true to your strong embrace of science on the one hand, and really is supporting people, not invalidating them. I've run into so many people who, you know, it comes out somewhere in the conversation, they say, oh, do you know my good friend Stanley Krippner? I mean, these are people from all over the world, and you have all these people that say, Stanley Krippner, my good friend. Those two phrases always go together. So,
Tu eres muy simpático, as we say in Spanish. You're very kind, very thoughtful.
Now, back in the 70s, you traveled to what was then the USSR to check out a lot of the claims made by Ostrander and Schroeder in their best-selling book, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain. What did you find there?
Well, I didn't find as much as Ostrander and Schroeder claimed. Now, Ostrander and Schroeder were friends of mine and were very helpful to me in terms of making contacts. But, you know, they were journalists. They were popular writers. And so they did a little bit of, shall we say, dramatic exaggeration.
Yes.
But on the other hand, one of the very interesting things that I found out about is that the Soviets, who had actually been murdering shamans and folk healers for years because they were not Marxists, did a quick change of pace and began to try to go to the shamans in Siberia to find out tricks from them that they could use for strategic purposes.
Mm.
And I found out that they were actually taking these shamanic techniques to try to confuse the minds of politicians in Washington and get them to make stupid decisions.
Hey, it's working.
They succeeded all too well.
Right. It seems it's finally kicking in.
That's right. I'm afraid there's a layover, right?
Yeah.
Residual effect.
Yeah.
Now, this was a good connection for me to make because once the Soviet Union dissolved, shamanism became an even stronger field of study, and I have been to Russia several times for conferences with shamans, and they have flown them in from Siberia, and they've brought their equipment with them. We've had wonderful drumming ceremonies, and they come with their traditional costumes, and they do their chants and their songs and their healing, and they are the sons or daughters or grandsons or granddaughters of the shamans who were killed by the communists or who had to go into hiding. Some of them buried their drums, and 50 years later, their sons and daughters and grandchildren dug up the drums and started using them again. It's really quite a remarkable story.
Really, yes. Yes, it is. Looking back a little bit more, what's your evaluation of the remote viewing research that was conducted by Puthoff and Targ at the Stanford Research Institute? And people may not be familiar with that research, so you might just briefly characterize it.
Well, this is a type of what parapsychologists call clairvoyance, where you see something at a distance, combined with telepathy, where you supposedly read somebody's mind. Targ and Puthoff did develop a very ingenious device of randomly selecting a location that the outbound person would drive to, and then while they were at that location, the inbound person would do remote viewing. They would try to find them, and they would draw a picture and dictate an account of what was going on. And then using techniques very similar to the techniques we had pioneered in our dream telepathy studies, there would be these matchings, trying to match the description with the location. And this really spawned a whole new area of research. Now there have been several remote viewing studies by people in different laboratories all over the world. And I think that the first remote viewing studies were a little bit unsophisticated and open to questions in terms of their rigorous controls. But I think that as time went on, they tightened the controls. And now the remote viewing studies that are being done, I think, are rigorous enough so that we can give some confidence to the results. And the results are quite impressive, to tell you the truth. And mm-hmm. I think they should be taken seriously.
Interesting. Going back again, there was the famous Uri Geller, the famous psychic spoonbender, and I know you had some contact with him as well. What's your take on him as you look back?
Well, Geller and I have always had a very cordial relationship, and one time we were going to be on a program together, a TV program, by the way, and we were backstage, and he said, "And he, Stanley, I know that you're very skeptical about my abilities, and I'd like to give you a demonstration right now. I'm going to give you a pencil and paper, and I'd like you to just draw something on it. Then I'm going to turn my back, and I will try to draw just what you've drawn." Well, you know, I know the old trick of where a magician will do that, and
yes,
he'll turn his back, and we'll have a little mirror. And by looking in the mirror, he can see the way that the pencil moves. So I said, "Fine, Uri, I'll just step outside the door." So I stepped outside the door, drew a picture, came back in. He showed me his picture. I showed him mine. Sorry, but there was no match.
Okay.
And he said, "Well, we'll have to try again some other time."
Well, of course.
Now, on the other hand, I'll say something in favor of Uri, because later on that television show, another friend of mine, the amazing Randy, was telling me that he really was going to expose Geller because he had an actor friend in Australia pretend to be a psychic, went on radio and said to people, "Bring your electrical equipment with you that's broken down, watches, toasters, computers, and focus on them, and I will focus on them, and they'll start running again." And sure enough, people phoned in on all sorts of electrical appliances that started to work, even though this guy was an out-and-out fake. Well, Geller got up. He did the same thing for the television audience, and people were phoning in from all over the country because it was live television. Watches had started to work that hadn't worked before, etc. And then Randy showed his television clip of the actor in Australia thinking to expose Geller. And so then the television camera went to Geller, and Geller said, "But this is what I keep telling people. The power doesn't come from me, it comes from the people themselves." And so even a fraudulent psychic can stimulate that power that people have within themselves. That was very, very clever.
Yes.
Of course, from my point of view, when people take something that hasn't worked for a while, shake a little bit, hold it, maybe exert some bodily heat that melts the wax or cleans out the insides, it'll start running spontaneously. But I didn't get a chance to say that on television. The drama was exciting enough between these two protagonists.
Yeah, I regularly fix things by banging on them or shaking them. Interesting that you bring up James Randi, and I'm surprised to hear you refer to him as your friend.
I was just in Las Vegas with Randi. I was a speaker at his Skeptics Conference.
Really?
There were nearly 900 people there, the biggest collection of skeptics that has ever assembled under one roof.
Yeah, so he's a leading skeptic, and he's offered a large cash prize to anyone who could demonstrate a psychic effect.
That's right, and the fact that nobody has collected shows how elusive these abilities are.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, people will say, well, Randi put so many preconditions on it that it makes it possible. No, I don't think that's the reason at all. I think that the phenomena are just really outside of easy control because there are so many variables. Like I say, these abilities, whatever they might be, are the results of a very complex system. Now, when I was in Las Vegas speaking at Randy's conference, I said, "Randi, I'll be happy to speak at your conference, but I'm not going to speak on parapsychology because they'll have their minds made up." And so instead, I talked about one of my other lecture topics, rational and irrational beliefs about HIV and AIDS.
Hmm.
And the audience loved it because there is so much irrational thinking that's killing people off in different parts of the world, including our own country, that was a really good topic for the skeptics.
Wow. Well, if you ever want to give me another interview, I'll bring you back to talk about that. This could be another outlet for that information.
Well, you see, this does get into paranormal topics because in Africa, there is one group of sorcerers who is telling people if you have sex with a virgin, you will get over AIDS. So they go out and rape all of these girls, and all of them die from AIDS.
Oh, my goodness.
And then there's another group in another part of Africa saying, well, if you have sex with a woman past menopause, you will get over AIDS. So they rape a woman who is past menopause, and then they all die from AIDS.
Mm.
But this irrational thinking is not only taking place in Africa. And paranormal beliefs are not only in Africa, in our own country. People are saying God is killing homosexuals.
Right.
AIDS is the agent of his justice. And I say, well, how come so few lesbians die of AIDS then?
Mm-hmm.
Much less what you hear from our government on the topic. And just go to the websites and you find out that the use of condoms is really put down and is deemed as ineffective protection, which we know that it is not. It's really very effective protection if used properly.
Right.
So I could go on and on about irrational paranormal beliefs about HIV and AIDS, but that's what I talked about at Randy's Skeptics Conference.
Okay, interesting.
Now again, I said something about positive about Uri Geller. I should say something positive about Randi. He has exposed some fraudulent faith healers who were keeping people from seeking medical help and were giving him fairly large amounts of money. So this is all in his book, The Faith Healers. And so he has done a good service by exposing some of these people.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I was struck in the beginning of our conversation. You said you don't believe in much, but I gather you do believe in some sort of rudimentary psychic phenomena. And I'm wondering if you've had any sorts of experiences yourself that, you know, personal experiences that would reinforce your sense that there's something going on, you know, more than meets the eye, so to speak.
Well, my position is that, yes, there's something going on here, but it's not paranormal. It's normal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not supernatural. It's natural. And that's the framework that I operate in. And I actually took part in one of our dream telepathy experiments back at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn. And I must say I did fairly well. The picture was of a mountain, of a chasm, a valley between two mountains. And I had a dream that I was mountain climbing and I fell down this chasm into the void below. Unfortunately, I woke up. So that was my one experience in a controlled laboratory setting that's worth talking about.
Yeah, what about in uncontrolled non-laboratory settings? Have you had other intimations?
I've had experiences. They could all be coincidental, but perhaps mm-hmm. the most poignant experience I had was when I was working with Spotted Fawn, who was the wife of Rolling Thunder, a noted Native American shaman and medicine man. And Spotted Fawn was being treated for cancer in San Francisco, and I was going to see her several times a week, giving her hypnosis to help ease the pain. And then I went off to Mexico for a conference, and on the last night of the conference, I actually had a dream, and in the dream, Spotted Fawn came to me and said, "You know, I will not be seeing you on this earth again."
Mm.
And I got back to San Francisco, and that was the very night that she died.
Wow, yeah.
Now, of course, I knew her death was coming. This might have been coincidental, but still it was a very poignant experience.
Sure, and so many other people have had similar experiences that it's hard for me to chalk it up just to coincidence. But I have to say your own views match my own quite closely about the paranormal versus normal and so on. I know that you've studied, you mentioned Rolling Thunder and Spotted Fawn and the shamans in Russia, and I know that you've studied indigenous healers in various parts of the world. What's been your take on all that?
Well, I actually go to Munich, Germany twice a year to lecture on the topic of ethnomedicine to physicians and medical students, along with several other people, most of them medical anthropologists. And there's a certificate program in Germany that's actually bringing people now from various parts of Europe. And I describe the medical systems of several Native American tribes, also Mexican folk healing, also folk healing in Brazil and other parts of the world that I have visited.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what most people don't realize is that Western allopathic biomedicine only services about 20% of the people in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The other 80% are serviced by traditional folk medicine. And so the United Nations has launched this program to bring the two together and to do some testing of folk medicine to see what's effective and what is not effective, and also to see how the two systems can work together, the Western allopathic biomedicine and the traditional folk medicine, of which, of course, there are hundreds of varieties around the world. Now, just because something is folk medicine doesn't mean that it's valid or useful or good, and I cited the examples of the treatment for AIDS a few minutes ago. However, many of the herbs and plants that are used in traditional medical centers by shamans and folk healers and the like have been taken into the laboratory and have been found to be effective, especially with Chinese and Tibetan medicines, but also many Native American medicines. Most people don't realize that Native Americans, before the Europeans arrived, had a pharmacopoeia that was quite impressive. Of course, each of the 500 tribes had their own pharmacopoeia, but the Rappahannocks perhaps had the most advanced pharmacopoeia because it was far more effective than the medicines that the Europeans brought to the United States at that time.
Wow.
So there is something that we can learn from not only the herbs, but the ritual and the ceremony that is done to accompany them, which probably boosts the immune system and gets the peptides to kick in and helps the inner self-healing properties of the sick person to facilitate the healing.
Yes. Now, some years back, you moved away from conducting parapsychological research. What was behind that decision?
Well, we simply ran out of money. That's when I came to San Francisco to work with the Saybrook Graduate School. And so I have been working with graduate students and teaching ever since. And in the meantime, I must say most of the parapsychology laboratories in the United States back in the 1960s and 70s have gone out of business because they've run out of money.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of the parapsychological research in the world today is being done in Europe, and not very much of it in Europe either. I would say that there are two or three well-funded programs in Europe, and really only one stable program in the United States, and that's at the University of Virginia, where Ian Stevenson and his group are studying past life experiences.
Okay.
So parapsychology is a poverty science. There's not really much research going on any place in the world. And so when money comes your way, you simply have to make the most of it and do the best that you can.
Well, where was the money coming from back when you were involved in it?
It was coming from private sources, from foundations, and from individual donors. Some other groups were being funded by the U.S. government, but this was at the time of the Vietnam War, and we actually refused money from the CIA because we didn't want to have anything to do with the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, I ended up not only with an FBI file, but a CIA file. I got copies of it through the Freedom of Information Act, and so I'm certainly on the government list and have been for several decades. But, you know, you pay a price for being patriotic. I did not think the Vietnam War was in the best interests of our country. I still don't think it is in the best interests of our country. And I did my best in a number of different ways to oppose the war without in any way endangering the lives or the morale of the troops that were fighting. And one of the projects I'm engaged in right now is writing a book with a former student of mine on post-traumatic stress disorder among veterans of all of the U.S. wars, from the Second World War to the Iraq War, because there are still some survivors of the Second World War who have post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sure. And doesn't it feel like Vietnam all over again? With Iraq?
It feels that way. The situation is actually different politically, which is, we don't have to go into right now. But when you have people like William Bulkley, who was a conservative icon, saying that the Vietnam War is a failure, then you know that something
you mean Iraq?
Really erroneous is going on.
Yeah, you mean the Iraq War is a failure. You said Vietnam.
Iraq War.
Yeah. Among your books, I believe you wrote an autobiography titled Song of the Siren.
My least successful book.
How would you
care? The only way you can get it today is to read the Japanese version.
Really? No, it's on eBay. I took a look. You can there are used copies out there on eBay and Amazon.com. How would you characterize the siren that has called to you in your life? What has that siren been?
Well, it is simply the lure of the unknown. And you have to be very careful when you're exploring fringe areas and unknown areas and borderline areas, because what the sirens did in the Odyssey by Homer was to lure sailors to rocky shores and then wreck their ships.
That's right.
And sometimes eat their bodies.
Uh-oh.
And I've seen many people exploring these borderline areas go off the deep end and wreck their careers and wreck their reputations and not learn anything in the process. So you have to be very, very careful and stay clear of the sirens when you hear their call. And so that's what the siren represents to me.
Okay. Stanley, is there anything I've missed that you'd want our listeners to know?
I suppose the advice that I typically give is to be open to unusual experiences, see what you can learn from them, but also be skeptical and see if there's an ordinary explanation for them. And be careful who you tell about them, because there still is a large number of people in this country who believe that telepathic experiences, precognitive experiences, out-of-the-body experiences and the like are the work of the devil. There's another large group of people in this country who think they're signs of psychopathology. It's mentally ill if they have these experiences. Well, neither of these extremes are valid, in my opinion. These are simply experiences that we don't have an ordinary explanation for, and a small group of us are trying to find out how to reconcile them in a scientific framework and find out more about the human condition by doing it. Yes, a lot of them are chance, a lot of them are coincidental, but so what? They're still affecting people's belief systems in some way, and we want to find out about that too. Why are people taking them seriously or not taking them seriously? So there's something that we can learn from any of these experiences if we approach them in a skeptical but open-minded way.
Very good. Hey, Stanley, I am so pleased to be able to join the legion of people who refer to my good friend Stanley Krippner, and I want to thank you so much for this interview.
Well, thank you, my good friend David Van Noyes.
Okay, bye-bye. I certainly hope you enjoyed my interview with Stanley Krippner and that maybe you learned something in the process. In case you're wondering where I stand in relation to so-called paranormal phenomena, I would have to say my own views are much like Stanley's. I agree with him that words like paranormal and supernatural are the wrong words. I believe whatever is going on is a part of our natural world that we don't yet understand. And like Stanley, I would also have to say I don't believe much. Actually, I was quite surprised to hear him say that, given his long involvement with parapsychology. At the same time, however, I do think there's more going on than meets the eye. The degree of my belief in these non-ordinary phenomena seems to fluctuate, but every now and then, I have an experience of synchronicity that reminds me that there's a bigger picture. Synchronicity, by the way, is Carl Jung's term for coincidences that are just too strong to not seem meaningfully connected. And I've gone through periods in my life where there were amazing runs of synchronicity, and I love it when that happens. I take it as a sign that I'm on the right path, and that these synchronistic happenings are signposts marking the way. At such times, I have a strong intimation that there is an intuitive sense that guides me. I'm at a stage in my own life where I want to nurture that sense and live my life as intuitively as possible.
I'm Jack Ward from the Sonic Society podcast, and you're on the couch with Shrink Wrap Radio. Dr. Dave will be back in a moment.
Hey, Jack, thanks for that cool transition. Be sure to check out Jack's podcast, which you'll find by searching on iTunes for Sonic Society. Speaking of searching, how are folks going to find you on the web if you don't have a website, or maybe lots of websites? Well, as a Shrink Wrap Radio listener, if you use the special discount code of SHRINK3, that's SHRINK and the numeral 3, you can buy your own .com domain name at GoDaddy.com for just $6.95. That's a $2 savings off the regular price. And I have other GoDaddy discounts for you, which you can find out about by going to my site at shrinkwrapradio.com. Just think, you could buy the domain name iloveshrinkwrapradio.com or faithfuldrdavelistener.com. The possibilities boggle the mind. Okay, that's it for the mail. I mentioned last time that I'm going to be conducting a weekend workshop in Ireland in the early part of May. I am still wondering if I have any Irish listeners lurking out there. If so, I'd love to hear from you, and perhaps we could have a visit when I'm in your country. Next, I want to let you know about next week's show, in which I'll interview Dr. Alberto Violdo. He's the leading expert on shamanism. He also co-authored a book on the topic with Stanley Krippner, today's guest, and once upon a time, he was my student. Regardless of your attitudes about shamanism, I think you will find this to be a fascinating interview. I'd love to hear from you. Please send email to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Our show notes are at www.shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemail for ShrinkPod on Skype or Gizmo Project. And we also have a phone in the U.S. where you can leave voicemail. That number is 206-888-2746. Stay tuned after our closing theme music to hear the PodSafe music selection, Common Ground, by New York's Central Park singer-songwriter David Eppolito. Go to the show notes to find links to David Eppolito, who has a most interesting story behind his musical career. My guest Stanley Krippner spent much of his life in New York City, and he has also devoted his life to international goodwill and understanding, seeking common ground. So I think this selection is particularly fitting for his appearance on our show. Finally, we close with promos for two excellent podcasts. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Up a flag, come blow the horn, forget the truth you knew when you were born. Teach your children as you whisper in their ear, teach them the reasons and the need for their fear. Draw them a map, one that defines all the nations of the world separated with black lines. Never mind a bird that's sailing high up in the winds, looks down and can't see where one ends and one begins. And someday we may be bound to tear the borders down. That's the day we'll meet on common ground. Shout from the left, shout from the right, scream that it's day. If the other swears it's night, raise your banner up, defend it with pride, pausing only to attack the other side. But all of those who play that tired game won't get beyond the finger pointing and the blame. They'll stay locked inside that darkness till they see the still the key. And someday we may be bound to lay our banners down. And that's the day we'll meet on common ground. One high school afternoon, the first photographs of our planet from the moon. Silent sky, blue island, spinning in space. Since then, I felt it's such a tiny place. And someday we may be bound to lay our hatred down. The truth is we all live on common ground. Someday we may be bound to lay our anger down. The truth is we all live.
In every child is a story, a song, a voice.
I want to find my voice.
I have something to say.
I have something important to say.
Podcast for Good was begun on the premise that within each child lies something special, just waiting for the perfect medium through which it can be released.
I have a story to tell.
Won't you listen to me?
I have good ideas.
My voice has value.
Visit podcastforgood.org.
Listen to me.
Inspire me.
Teach me. Lead me. I am your future.
I am your future.
Teach me.
Hey, psychology fans. This is Dani from the Audio Addicts blog, and you're listening to Shrink Wrap Radio. After you're finished with this episode of Learning About the Mind, come join me in the Theater of the Mind and listen to the Sonic Society. Coming to you from the other side of North America in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Each week, the Society meets to bring you the very best in modern radio drama from around the world. Get all the details at sonicsociety.org. And make sure you check out the Addicts blog and embrace your audio addiction at theaudioaddicts.com. Hey, Dr. Dave, do you think audio addiction is a psychology that should be explored in a future episode?